Time for breakfast.
Trauma for Breakfast is a crowded table of wounded children, parents, spouses, caregivers, and weary souls. Together, we join in honest conversations about the behaviors and challenges of parenting and working with children who have experienced trauma. There's always room for one more at the table to share in the stories, science, and healing as we learn to better understand and care for each other. We are a table without shame or judgment, because life can be hard and lonely, and we all know that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. I'm Stacy. I'm a mother of 7 children and have fostered for over 13 years. As an RN and former public school teacher, I quickly realized this type of parenting was not taught in a textbook or class. Let's learn together to parent different, not harder. Welcome to Trauma for Breakfast. Welcome back to Trauma for Breakfast. This is part 2. So if you missed part 1 with Doug Dolan, empathy versus enabling, you're going to want to go back and listen to part 1 before joining into part 2, because he unpacked a lot around the definition and the understanding of what those two things are and what they look like. And this episode, we are going to be talking application, which means, okay, great, Doug, thanks for all the information, but what do I do with this in regards to fill in the blank? Welcome back, Doug. Thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you for giving me the opportunity, because I think this is really critical, you know, for a lot of family members.
Well, let's just jump right in. And I would love if you could dig into your box of case studies or stories and give us some examples of empathy and an example of enabling that you have seen in those you've worked with or those that you've lived by.
Yes. So on the empathy side, I remember a mother who brought her son here to come visit us to do an interview for us to talk to see, hey, is this an appropriate program for the individual? She felt it was. The son wasn't yet ready to make a decision, and she told him, I'm not taking you back with me, meaning I believe this is the right place for you. Now, he chose not to stay. He went back to their home state, but a month later, she was bringing him back. I picked him up from the airport, and I was bringing him to the program. We got on the topic of love. I asked the young man, what's your definition of love? And he talked about good feelings. And I asked him to look over at his mom, and I said, does she look like she's feeling good right now? Because she was in tears, and she was a mixture of fear, frustration, and again, crying. And he said, no. And I said, she's actually doing the most loving thing she can for you. She knows that you're really struggling, and she's willing to make adjustments to get you into our program that's going to set you on a healthier path if you do this. And it doesn't always feel good. But what she's not going to do is she's not going to take you back home. She's not going to continue to pay your bills. She's not going to do these other things that she's done for you in the past that were really enabling behaviors. So some of the, again, on the enabling side, I've seen a mixture of things where, again, the individual is really struggling, and mom and dad have kind of gotten to the point to believe that their loved one is incapable of taking care of themselves. So they're paying for their rent, they're paying for their car, they're paying for their phone. They don't require that they go get a job. They're not asking them to really stand on their own 2 feet. And, you know, what we share with them is, well, if they have all their consequences in essence buffered for them or taken care of for them, why would they change? Even to the degree, I know some parents who have gone out and bought the drugs for their kids because they have some belief, well, at least I know where I'm getting them from, which is completely unhealthy. One, because of the enabling side, but two, because of, no, most of the time you don't know what you're getting, especially what we've seen with the fentanyl crisis. And I sit on a committee to review all the overdose fatalities for our county. I look at the toxicology reports. We do family interviews. I've known in personal cases, and I've also done training with the DEA, you know, just in the DEA alone, by the way, in 2021, with the tens of millions of counterfeit prescription medication that they confiscated back in 2021, when they tested all those, 40% had a lethal dose of fentanyl in it. In 2022, it was up to 60%. So those numbers continue to rise. So we're finding fentanyl in THC products, in cocaine, with meth, with other opioids. We're seeing in a wide variety of products. So you may think you know what you're buying for your loved one, but you have no idea what you're going to be getting. So you're going to be enabling them. Basically, you're telling them it's okay for you to go ahead and use these substances and I will get them for you. Again, why would they change?
And Doug, this is a little bit off topic, but why are all of the drugs being cut with fentanyl? Can you explain why that is?
So it really happens for two predominant reasons. And again, I went through this training with the DEA. We were even able to see where they did it. The DEA, by the way, doesn't just work inside of our borders. The DEA works internationally. So they're trying to arrest individuals and stop drugs from flowing into the United States outside of our borders. Hopefully they never get here. And so they showed us some videos of raids that they did on mountaintop labs of the Sinaloa cartel down in Mexico. And so these are not controlled environments. You have these vats and these bins and all of this material that's processing through a wide variety of different substances. So in that case, they may have just done a batch of powdered fentanyl. Then they're doing a batch, let's say, of cocaine, and some of it's just cross-contamination. So that's one issue. The second issue is if we go back to if somebody believes that they're buying cocaine and you have drug dealer A and drug dealer B, drug dealer A, if he knows I want some kind of edge over my competition, I'll lace it with some fentanyl because it's going to give you a more potent high and it's going to get you addicted that much faster. And at the end of the day, if you die from it, they don't care because business is booming.
I appreciate what you said about empathy and enabling. I know just from a very personal level, one of the hardest things that we ever had to do was to place one of our children in therapeutic residential care. And there's nothing harder as a parent, and I get emotional even talking about it, than to walk with your child and leave them with someone like a Doug Dolan and just knowing like this is what they need. And yes, it feels almost like death as a parent because you think like, I can't fix this. But at the same time, letting them stay and continue in their addictions and their behaviors is enabling. And empathy as a foster and adopt parent or as a parent across the board is not always popular.
Correct.
It's not always popular. And there are people that will look at you and say, wow, you weren't enough, or you shouldn't have done this, or don't you love your child enough, or how did this happen? When in the reality is that it's the thing your child needs. There's a time that it's beyond your ability and your scope to be able to help your child. And that's when you call in professionals. And so I just wanted to throw that out there because the hardest thing that my husband and I have ever done is to drive away from somewhere without our child, but also knowing that that was the best way to show them love.
So. Absolutely. And I appreciate you sharing that. You know, for me, what I think about with that is like two primary things. One is I've done some service work with a organization called Fish for Life, which is out of Southern California. And it takes special needs kids and young adults out on fishing trips and does this big celebration with it. When we see somebody who has Down syndrome, we already process them as a special needs individual because you can see it in their facial features. You can hear it in language and things of that nature. And so you reframe that individual. But when it comes to a substance use disorder, when it comes to other mental health issues, we don't always reframe them in a certain way as a special needs individual. They have special needs. And if you've never been trained to work with those special needs, it's actually enabling to try to work on it on your own, right? It would be healthier, it would be more empathetic to turn them over to the people who know how to process and work through those orders. The second thing is it's very similar to this is why you don't have, let's say, a surgeon do surgery on their own family members. You're too enmeshed emotionally. And that's both you, in essence, as the surgeon, but it's also them as the patient. It's like having that separation and being able to process with other people often goes better than to just try to handle it on your own, especially the more complex these situations become. And that's why, you know, a formula that I use and I tell people about, if I'm the parent and if you're the child, it is my desire and I choose to approach you with empathy and compassion, but I'm going to ask two things of you if you're struggling. One is to take responsibility for your choices. And although other things may be impacting you, things of trauma, it's I'm trying to empower you to say you have the power of choice. You may not like all the choices that you have options of, but you get to choose your choices. The second thing is I need you to get into healthy action to the best of your ability. If that individual is willing to take responsibility and get into healthy action, I'll continue to support them with empathy and compassion. But if they don't, if they choose, no, I'm a victim of this, you know, I'm just reactionary in this, I get no say in this, and they're not willing to get into the healthy action that they could, if I continue to support that, my empathy will turn into enabling behaviors. And it can even go so far as when that doesn't work, because I'm not, in essence, controlling the outcome of what I'm hoping for, people usually then revert to anger, resentment, fear, frustration, and some just go to pure apathy. I've actually had a number of family members say, I feel really guilty about this, but I just got to a point that I wish they would die so I didn't have to deal with this anymore. And so it's being able to educate self and it's being able to educate the other person. Again, I want to have that healthy empathy and compassion for you, but I need you to take ownership for yourself and I need you to get into healthy action to the best of your ability. If you do that, again, I'm all in. If you don't, I need to know how to detach with love.
I like what you said about victimhood, because that is a lot of what we were asking for. And the answer always was, but if I had this, or if this hadn't happened, or you did this, instead of any type of ownership of, okay, I did this and I'm sorry, or this was wrong. There was none of that ever.
Well, you can end up victimizing them if you enable them and say, I get it. You know, that was beyond your ability. No, we're all to grow and own what we think, what we feel, and the actions that we're doing from there. Now, again, we may be under very stressful situations, but if we never take on that ownership, we will never be empowered to have any kind of control or say in our life, because everything external to us will need to change for us to feel safe, for us to feel okay. And the reality of that happening in the world is it won't. So it's actually more empowering to learn these coping skills and these actions of what we can take. So we have a sense of agency, a feeling like, okay, even though when I'm dealt some cards that I don't feel good about, I still feel like I have the capability to be able to move through this and still survive.
I want to add this on to something you said earlier, because I think anybody that is in this situation where they have a child or a family member who has gone into a recovery or who has moved out or who has been incarcerated or who's any of these things where the consequences of their behaviors kind of come to fruition, I believe there's also a lot of grief for the family that's left behind, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that for us, there were, and Doug, I don't know how it was with your brother, but I know for us, there were times that we felt very guilty because it was like, oh my gosh, we love him and it's hard, but holy cow, we didn't realize the stress, the strain, the pain, the hard of every single moment of every single day of trying to know, is he doing this? Did he do this? Can I fix this? Can I control this? And then when you have this relief, you feel this guilt because it's like, oh my gosh, I feel so guilty. I feel this way. But at the same time, there's so much relief because like you said, you're not the surgeon operating on their own child or it's a relief.
It is. No. And again, you know, I've experienced that and I know a lot of our clients, their families have experienced that as well. And they do feel guilty. And it's like, it's okay. Because again, you've been under such pressure to try to figure out what's the right thing to do when you don't have the answers. It's like, I feel some relief that hopefully they're somewhere safe. They're working with somebody who understands this. I didn't abandon them. I actually did the best thing for them by putting them into, you know, a situation where they can get the help that they need. You know, so it's almost as if, unfortunately, I have a lot of cancer in my family. All four of my grandparents had cancer. Other people in the family has had cancer. My mom's had cancer. And so if somebody, if like one of somebody in my family gets cancer, if I feel guilty because I can't cure them of cancer, I never went to school for that. I don't know what to do about that. But if I feel like I have to be that person for them, I'm going to make them sicker. I'm going to make me sick in the process. It's healthier I turn them over to a well-trained doctor and other medical team to go do that. I'm not abandoning them. It's the best thing I can do for them. But when it comes to certain feelings or other mental health issues, we somehow as human beings take it on as the responsibility. We should be able to do all these things. And most of this, you don't learn until you have to. And even when you have to, you're already behind the curve on what you need to learn. The best you can do is get them into that situation and then participate with the professionals on learning this for yourself. So hopefully when they come out of a program, you're both in a better position to understand each other and what are the healthy ways that you can engage in your relationship.
Well, and I would say, like you said earlier, even if you are expert, you are a cancer doctor, you're not going to treat your own loved one.
Right, exactly. Because you're too susceptible in those situations. You're too close to other emotional attachments where there's a healthier emotional detachment in another way. It doesn't mean the individual is totally emotionally detached, but that's where they're taking the dose as if I understand what you're feeling and going through. When we're so emotionally enmeshed, it can be emotionally overwhelming for us.
Well, I would love for you to end with, you were talking about some five steps that you would share.
Yes. So for the loved one of, whether it's the parent, the sibling, whoever it may be, for you to experience healthy emotions instead of getting into enabling behavior, I always recommend it starts with working on yourself. How are you working on you mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually? Because you got to look at two things. One is, it's almost as if two people are drowning and you're hoping to be the rescue swimmer in this situation, but you haven't been practicing swimming. You don't know how to swim in this situation. The likelihood is you're both going to drown. So one is I've got to be working on me so I'm healthier with solutions. And two, I'm also more aware and of greater strength to be able to detach with love if I need to, in the hopes that will create the opportunity for my loved one to choose to get well, to actually then take responsibility and get into healthy action. So it starts with working on you. Plus, if unfortunately, like in my brother's situation, that it does lead to the ultimate sacrifice, you are that much stronger for not taking on the guilt, the shame, thinking you could have controlled the outcome. Because otherwise your brain goes into hyper mode of why, what could I have done? And that'll drive you crazy. The second thing is, by working on that in the moment, I'm stronger to pause. I can suspend my biases, my prejudices, you know, my fears, my frustrations, to better understand what's going on with my loved one who's struggling, which, as you and I both know, they're communicating with us. They just may not be communicating with us in what's kind of traditional healthy communication. So that individual that's struggling may be acting out. And if we think, well, I'm just taking it personally, you're disrespecting me, you're not paying attention to what they're trying to communicate with you. And we're more likely to react out of anger or frustration. So it's to work on me. I need to pause in the moment, not take things personally, and suspend what I believe or what I perceive, because that's not what they believe and what they perceive in the moment. And then I want to follow up as a third thing is get curious and find out what's really going on with the individual. Can they communicate in some way that I could better understand and steel man that position of what they're going through? And it's then when I hear that, like we talked about earlier, and I'm collecting that information, I'm just getting into acceptance of what is. I'm not getting into what should be or how they should feel or how they should think. It's like, that's not going to help them. That's putting expectations on them that they're already failing at. They know they're failing at it in some kind of way. They need some greater empathy, and that comes out of curiosity and accepting with what is, without saying, I agree with it, I like it, or we have to be stuck with it. I just understand that's what's going on with you. So ultimately, you know, the fifth step is we can choose the healthiest course of action. And by the way, the healthiest course of action does not mean I'm going to give my loved one what they want. I'm going to provide what they need, and they may not like me in the moment for doing it. I may not even to some degree like me in the moment of doing it. Like you talked about, hey, we left our son at a facility. You might have really struggled with your own feelings of self-worth and am I doing the right thing? But knowing, yes, this is something we're either too close to and or it's not something we're adept at handling, or that he may even want us to be the one to handle it or work through with him. So the best I can do is the healthiest course of action is I'm going to turn you over to some other people and he may not like you in the moment.
Well, it was interesting because they definitely told us what to expect because there's that pattern, right? And so sure. his first responses to us were, it's so bad here. And you guys, I'm going to do what you asked me to do. And it's, they treat me this way and all of the things. And so it was good to have a program for him that knew this is what kids in the program are going to say to you. And it was really formulaic in that sense, because it was like, wow, did you write the letter for him that he's been writing?
Yeah.
Because they, you know, obviously when you're dealing with some of the stuff that he was dealing with, they all are going to kind of say the same things, because as much as a parent and someone that trains on these things and does these things, I wish I could say that my husband and I avoided any of those cycles of what I think were probably enabling behaviors in order to try and save him. Right. And realizing, right. Whoa, we have to stop, pause. Right. Like you said, be curious in the moment and really recognize like this is beyond our abilities. And it's a very humbling thing, a very humbling thing to ask someone else to help you with your child or your loved one, you know, that is struggling.
Well, and in that situation, by the way, because I know you and your husband and you work on you, although it can be painful, it's better that it is humbling than you take it on as being humiliating. Yeah. Because some parents will take it on as humiliation and it either makes me look bad or I failed. And typically in response to that, what they do is they usually engage in more enabling behavior to try to feel like I've resolved my feelings of humiliation because I fixed this. And it's usually something that's outside of their control. Plus, you know, if it's our child, they usually know us well and they usually know what buttons to push because they push those buttons before. Whereas with somebody who is a trained professional and a stranger in that situation, you know, they can't push those same buttons. Plus, it also helps when they do tell you, because I've often done this with family members, is let me tell you what the next couple of steps are going to look like. And then when their loved one actively lives that out, it's like, now you've got my attention yet again. I really trust you because my fortune teller, in essence, has come up with all these scenarios of how I thought I was going to be able to control this outcome and none of it's worked. And now somehow you told my loved one's fortune and they did act that out. I'm curious what else you might know that of how they may engage things.
No, and I also really loved how we were to match his letters to us and his, you know, if he wasn't going to be real in his letters, then we were surface in our letters. If he wrote three sentences about the weather, we wrote back three sentences about the weather, really. Yes. And those were really ways that it forced him to start to really engage in treatment and really start being honest and real about what he was struggling with. And, you know, again, I think it's a life-changing thing, but difficult. And so,
well, and in that situation, by the way, so you with your son, us with other clients who come to our program, sometimes the empathy and or enabling behaviors happen even after somebody helps their loved one admit. So how the enabling behaviors look is, I don't know what to do with my loved one, take them. Now, let me demand and tell you how you need to treat my loved one. When it's like, yeah, but you tried all those things and those things aren't working. Mm-hmm. The empathetic thing is to say, I want to cooperate with you as professionals and I'm allowing you to be in the lead because it hasn't been working with us so far, but can I be a part of the process and take your lead of not only helping my loved one, but help me too. I need to learn some things along the way. That's more empathetic.
Oh, absolutely. And we definitely had a lot to learn and have learned a lot through the whole process. But I will tell you, it never was a, we know what we're doing. It was always like, okay, help us know what to do next. And it's not easy. But yeah. I want to encourage families that it's okay to say, I need help. When you are especially parenting children with a high level of early adversity, this isn't, and I say this, this is not normal parenting. A child was designed to be parented by their parents. And when there's that loss in the beginning, and a lot of times there's substance exposure and all kinds of things or abuse that occurs before they come to your home, this is not normal parenting. It's okay to need help outside of what we would consider normal parenting. But I also would say that that's true for those that this is my biological child that's struggling with addiction, or my sister or my brother. It's okay, because there's just times it's outside our scope, and there's no shame in that.
Correct. And I think one last thing to add to that. So people are prepared for some of the feelings that they have, that they may have going through some of this, even when you may be trained in it. It's not the same thing as then when you have to actually go through it. Right. So if you've been through classes, but you haven't yet engaged those skills that you've been taught into a real world setting, it's not the same thing. So just realize, even though you have the education, you may be fumbling through it for a variety of reasons, right? And that's where it's still important to go out and ask for that help, have that sense of community, not feel like I'm the only one going through this and nobody would understand me. I mean, obviously other people understand it if they already told you the formula of what's likely to come from your son. It's like, well, I guess he's not unique in this situation. Yeah. They've seen this before.
And I will tell you this, and this goes against every fiber of my being, because if you know who I am in person, and Doug and Krista both do, I'm not a real emotional, huggy person who likes to get super deep with strangers. And one of the things that I attended, and I would recommend this to anyone with family in recovery, if they offer you a parent weekend or a family weekend or some type of a Zoom where others are on there, it was incredibly powerful to meet other families who were dealing and struggling with this. And I actually took one of my oldest with me to go to this, and it was good for him as well. But to be able to not feel so isolated was a huge thing. And I would just say that is one of the most powerful weekends I had ever been through, was to go to this and meet all these other families. And like you said, Doug, not feel alone in that. It just helped a lot. It helped a lot. Krista, do you have any questions for Doug before we wrap up?
I don't, but I'm really glad that he did mention enmeshed. I learned a new word today just because, Doug, can you explain a meshed relationship one more time?
Sure. And so it's where you're too tightly interwoven with, you know, again, let's say it's a parent and a child, that you lose perspective, any kind of healthy perspective of what's going on. You're too close to it. You can't see it from a wider standpoint. And to the degree, by the way, when we go into panic mode, we go into tunnel vision. And that's part of that enmeshment, is we can't take a step back and see the bigger picture. And that can be other resources that are available to us, healthy, empathetic behaviors, where otherwise I may be enabling in the moment. It's just too intertwined.
And I think reading about it too, it also makes you unhealthy, right? You become, just the thought of being without that person or not being able to help that person, you become anxious. So, and I guess I was thinking about that just because the way, you know, Stacy driving away, you know, was there a little bit of that like distance?
I would say a rendering or tearing.
Yeah.
It was absolutely, you know, I mean, you think about a mother-child relationship and, you know, this is my baby who I have rocked and held while sleeping and taught to walk and cheered him on in kindergarten graduation and second grade out on the soccer field. I mean, all of the moments that you become enmeshed like that as a parent and loving this child more than like I would die for each of my kids, literally walk in front of a bus for all of my kids. And in this moment, it felt that ripping because I was giving him to someone else in that moment. So yeah, it was, again, my husband and I literally sat in the parking lot and wept giant tears because we felt that loss of almost the death of a child. Anyway, that was not ending on a happy note for this podcast. So I want to ask a happy note question as we leave. Doug and Krista, I'd love for you to share, what are you reading currently?
The most recent book that I read is a book that's called Endure. And Endure is by Cameron Haynes. He is an individual that's known. He kind of got his start as a professional bow hunter, but he also challenges himself to do ultramarathons and those sorts of things. And so it's constantly challenging yourself to do more difficult things, stretch yourself outside of your comfort zone so that when you need to call upon those skills to endure, you can.
Ooh, I like that. Krista, what about you? Are you reading anything?
I picked up the book, Never Split the Difference, which was on a previous podcast with Chris Voss. Very good read. It's one of those that you could almost read several times because depending on where you are in your life, there's always a little tip in there for the way that you handle a situation. So loving that book.
Oh, it's fantastic. So have you asked for a raise yet from your boss, or have you bought a car?
Because I've put a couple things, you know, there was a situation where I actually used that, like starting, you know, giving a span of information versus, you know, when you're talking about like salary or those types of things, just a range, like when you're negotiating for a car, right?
Yep. Love it. That book, I do. I reference that book a lot. Mm-hmm, I've been reading Born for Love by Dr. Bruce Perry. What a fantastic book. I love Dr. Bruce Perry. This book is really great. And it's not one that's talked about a lot. He wrote it a while back ago. And it really talks a lot about the attachment process. And the whole thing is just case studies and science behind understanding that early childhood experience and the effect it has on not just the brain and that child, but society as a whole, how we've changed from living in tribes and living in community to now we're, you know, we don't live by grandparents. We don't live by in community where there's more than one person involved in the upbringing of a child. Now we have these single moms doing it on their own instead of the mom living with the dad in the village with aunts and uncles and grandparents and everyone helping to raise up a child. And so it's really, really interesting and good and also kind of scary. But
one last one, by the way, relative to trauma, one book that I really appreciate on trauma is called Trauma by Dr. Paul Conte. Really, really good book to talk about, you know, in our neurology and our biology, how we're impacted by trauma. And I think that's a good book for somebody who may be struggling with issues of trauma and for the loved ones to better understand and be empathetic for what their loved ones may be going through.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Doug, for joining us on Trauma for Breakfast. And as always with you, I feel like I just walked away with a fire hose of just incredible information. So you guys will want to rewind that again and again. Doug is going to really quickly tell us his email, and he's opened himself up to, if you have a personal question for him, he is going to answer. He's there for our listeners. And so I really appreciate that.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. So my personal email is Doug Dolan, D-O-U-G, D-O-L-A-N at recoveryinthepines.com.
Well, thank you all, and we hope you have a great day today.
We're so thankful that you all shared in today's conversation. We are always here and ready to set one more place at the table. Thanks for joining us on Trauma for Breakfast.
Trauma for Breakfast is brought to you and supported by Matt Force, working together to reduce substance abuse, and Yavapai County Community Health Services, working toward healthier communities.